Yeah, so to echo Connie's comment, I'm going to wait until the questions to bring out the coherence of my talk. It's ironic. I sympathize with all the speakers who've gone before, but when you're trying to do even a little bit of a review, you realize you can't tell a complete story anymore, which is just a little bit of a shame. But you get to cover more things. So let's talk a little bit about white dwarfs. We've seen this a few times. Yeah, so there's several reasons to study white dwarfs, but there's a lot of them, and that's one reason. Most stars are going to become white dwarfs, so they provide a good endpoint for stellar evolution. Specifically, if you're trying to figure out, gosh, what should the CO profile of my asymptotic giant branch models really be, then you'd like to use the white dwarf stars to help tell you that. All right, well, they're very simple objects. That's another reason to study them. They generally just have a carbon-oxygen core. They have a thin helium layer, maybe 1%, and they have an even thinner hydrogen layer, maybe 10 to the minus 4 of the total mass. Now, there's actually two flavors. The one I just described is the Da hydrogen atmosphere one. Some of them just don't have the hydrogen at all, and those are helium atmospheres, and we call them DBs. The physics that's going on, they're supported by electron degeneracy pressure, so as they cool, they really don't change radius, so that's very easy. The cooling is controlled merely or mostly by the heat capacity of the ions, so it's really like a chunk of iron cooling off. It loses heat at the surface. When they're hot, Steve mentioned this on Monday, greater than 25,000 degrees, they actually lose more energy in neutrinos than they do photons. And as they get very cool, the cores can freeze. The gravity is very, very high, like 10 to the 8 centimeters per second squared, so heavy elements sink. So that's the reason you get such efficiently separated envelopes of a hydrogen layer bubbling up and the helium layer bubbling up underneath that. In the core, these settling times are longer, but in the envelope, it's quite short. So one of the great boons of the 20th century, or I guess I should say the 21st century now, is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which was designed to find lots of quasars. And the great thing about quasars is they look like stars and they're blue. And the great thing about white dwarfs is they are stars and they're blue. And so it found a huge number of white dwarfs. Before, I don't know what the actual number of white dwarfs that was known was, but probably 2,000. And now with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, it's over 30,000. Now, of course, not all of them pulsate, and not all of them are bright enough to detect pulsations in them if they do. But before Sloan, we knew of about 35 pulsators, and today we know of about 160. So there's been a four or five-fold increase in the number of known white dwarfs. And here I've simply plotted a sort of HR diagram. This is gravity on this axis. And you can see the 160 or so pulsators down here. And these objects here with circles around them are white dwarfs which have not been observed to pulsate. And I'm just pointing this out because, you know, most white dwarfs have a log G of 8, but there is actually quite a spread due to other channels for producing white dwarfs. Okay, fortunately, we've had so many talks in this conference, I don't really have to explain what a G-mode is. Or I shouldn't say that. But unfortunately, I worked with Douglas so long that I looked at this slide just now and went, oh, that's incorrect. Because I said, oh, yes, the period goes like, they're evenly spaced in period, so it goes like n times delta p plus epsilon, where n is 1, 2, 3.
You're not the first person this week to make that mistake.
Okay, well, and what I should have said is where n is 10, 11, 12, 13. You know, in the asymptotic limit, that's more or less true.
That's not the only mistake.
Well, okay, you're right. I didn't put in the L dependence either. This is true.
That's not what I was thinking either.
Which one were you thinking of? Or perhaps we should wait.
You're equating a period with a frequency.
Oh.
Bottom line.
Oh.
It's not over, sorry.
Which one over? Okay, good.
I'm just
Good Lord. Anyway, now that we've successfully found that, who knows, if I looked at it longer, I might find more mistakes.
Please say, Douglas, you were wrong.
I don't think I could do that because I just can't. Wow, we've had several firsts at this conference. Okay, well, anyway, the driving mechanism, which I'm not going to talk very much about, is widely believed to be due to convective driving, which has been variously named the Brickhill effect as well, and it was discovered by John Brickhill in 92 and also worked out by Wu and Goldreich in the late 90s. And basically the idea is simply that the convection zone responds very quickly to the pulsations. The turnover time is of order a second or less, and the pulsation time scales are hundreds to a thousand seconds. And so it's a quasi-static approximation. The irony is, if you do the calculation wrong and assume the flux is frozen in, you get about the same answer. So morphologically, there's a threshold of energy to overcome to convince people that the way they've been doing it is wrong, because they're able to get very similar answers with an unphysical approximation. And that's just all this says here if you treat the kappa mechanism. So anyway, the blue, the hot edge, occurs when the very lowest overtone mode, where this quantity omega tau is about 1, where this tau is about 4 times the thermal time scale in the convection zone. Okay. Well, on to sort of adiabatic seismology. Here's a propagation diagram, and people have been showing things in acoustic radius. This is buoyancy radius, so it's related to the integral of the Brunt-Weissler frequency. And I just normalized it so it goes 0 to 1. Put the mass coordinates written on the top. And here you see that obviously G modes are the low frequency modes. They're down here below these two critical frequencies. And the outer turning point for this mode is given by the Lamb frequency. And for this longer period mode, the outer turning point is given as the base of the convection zone. So these are the outer boundaries here. Oh, and this indicates the 50%, 90%, and 99% mass point in the model. Oh, and you see these bumps here. These have to do with composition transition zones where you have chemical gradients in the core. So here's the oxygen profile. And as it decays, you get these bumps in the Brunt-Weissler frequency. And here's the helium in the envelope, and it's broader, and you see a bigger bump, but a wider bump. And of course, these are the kinds of things that G-modes probe, and so you'd hope to be able to learn something about these profiles. And here's another star, which is a DA, and so there's also a helium layer, and on top of that is a hydrogen layer, and so essentially you get one more bump. Okay, well, these bumps, as we've seen in other talks, can trap modes. So here's one particular mode. You can see it has an enhanced amplitude down there. The next mode has yet different trapping, and then this mode has even different trapping. And so this produces the change in the distribution of the kinetic energy, and it also produces the not quite evenness of the G-mode spacings. Heard too many solar talks. If you want to come up with a really simple way of describing this, if you start with the Cowling approximation theory, the way Douglas worked it out, where you're basically trying to write things so that it looks like a vibrating string, at least that's the way I think of it. And then you say, okay, I'm just going to do the vibrating string problem, but I'm going to put beads on my string, which are bumps that look like this. So imagine you're perturbing the sound speed on the string in this fashion, and that you're going to solve this equation. Then you can say, okay, well, what kind of trapping does that produce? And now I'm looking at the period spacing here, and these black circles are the result of a full numerical calculation where you have a transition zone. And so you just solve the adiabatic equations and you get that. And the red circles are if you just do the beads on the string. So if I just put a bead on the string, then I actually get trapping, which looks like this. And the thing that I liked about this is you actually get the sharp minima, not just a sinusoidal signal in the delta PU diagram, but a sharp minimum. Now, we can talk a little bit more about that later, but I'm just solving algebraic equations. I'm not solving differential equations in order to get that. So anyway, there's a good qualitative agreement, and it's non-perturbative. Okay, well, let's move on. So in other words, things work the way you think. Bumps produce regular signals in the periods. All right, well, this is work that was done by Travis in 2003, where he used seismology of GD358, a DB pulsator, to try to put constraints on the central oxygen abundance. And of course, the central oxygen abundance is related to the nuclear reaction rates that produce that oxygen abundance. And those rates are known to be uncertain at the level of somewhere between 20 and 50 or 100% even. And he found actually good agreement with the expected rate of that process. Now, recently, an Argentinian group led by Corsico and others, did ensemble seismology of 44 known pulsating white dwarfs. And so they basically, as we saw for the SDB stars, made a grid of models, and then for each set of observations found the best fitting grid point to that. And while I might have qualms with, you know, individual results, the ensemble result I think is probably pretty robust. And the main thing to get out of this is that this mostly found thick hydrogen layers of 10 to the minus 4, but also a distribution of thinner hydrogen layers. And this is, of course, one of these quantities that evolution codes have real trouble predicting, because this small amount of hydrogen is what's left over after the mass loss stage. And it's somewhere between 0 and 10 to the minus 4 the mass of the star. It can't be bigger than 10 to the minus 4, because if it were, nuclear reactions would occur and it would burn down to 10 to the minus 4. So people have always just assumed it's 10 to the minus 4 because that's the easy canonical value you can have. But it makes sense that mass loss is not the same in every star every single time. So that's an interesting result. All right, moving on to more, well, I don't want to say fundamental physics, but different physics. Crystallization. Imagine these are all ions moving around in a plasma, and imagine it's cooling off. So these are a sea of ions, classical ions, embedded in a electron degenerate gas, which is a neutralizing background and doesn't react much. And as you take energy out, you can see that these ions settle into lattice sites. Obviously, this is a two-dimensional calculation, because it shows up very much better when you plot things like this. But you can see you get nice regular crystal structures. And as the energy of the ions gets low enough, they can't get in between each other. And that's when you crystallize. And it's extremely easy, well, extremely well agreed upon that this happens when gamma equals 178. I should have defined gamma. It's the ratio of the Coulomb energy between the ions to KT, basically. And when it gets to 178, everybody agrees you get crystallization. And when I say everybody agrees, I mean like four different theorists agree. That is a big number. No, using a wide variety of techniques. Okay, well, it's always good to go and check these things, though. And so the question is what can seismology tell us about that? Well, there's one star which is a crystallized pulsator. I mean, if theory is correct, it should be crystallized. But we frankly don't know the degree of crystallization. This is what happens to the periods in a model as you vary the crystallization from 0% to 100%. And you see it does have a large impact on the periods. And in this star, we have several what we believe are consecutive values of n. And if you form the difference of that from some asymptotic period spacing, you get what looks like a nice sinusoidal signal. In other words, a sinusoidal signal produced by a bump somewhere. If you just make a model of the star, you might expect a bump here, here, and here. If you just want to explain that diagram I showed you, you really only need a bump here. This comes out of where the location should be, but that's assuming that the model is hardly crystallized. The position of the bump is relative to the deepest portion of the star the modes can get to. If instead it's 90% crystallized, then this is what you would call the bottom, and you now need a bump that's right about here. The reason I'm in favor of this is because, as you can see, in this case, you don't just have one bump, you've got one, two, three. And if you've got that complicated structure, then why doesn't this look more complicated? If you're more crystallized, however, you can hide this bump because it's not accessible to the fluid, it's frozen. This bump is too wide to do anything, and so you're really just looking at this bump. So I think our constraint on the crystallization when we actually do the calculation will be that we'll be crystallized enough so that this does not produce a large signal in the period spacings. 5 minutes, thank you. Okay. Like I said, I couldn't do everything. I can't explain this nonlinear light curve fitting, although Yanqing Wu can beautifully. It's her theory. What we've done is she did it in the perturbative limit where she looked at the first order nonlinearities. I'm solving the equations numerically, so we're keeping all the higher orders, we hope, and there's data, there's the fit. There's data on the same star with a different amplitude at a different time, and there's the fit. And they're quite good. You can do this for multiperiodic oscillators too. What you're interested in deriving is the thickness, or the thermal time scale rather, of the convection zone. And we believe we can do that fairly reliably. And when we did it for this particular star that was complicated, we got a lot more than we bargained for. We found that there was one region of the Fourier transform where you had what looked like two triplets interlaced. So a perfectly spaced triplet and another perfectly spaced triplet like this. And once I started looking at it, I realized there might be evidence of oblique pulsation, a la Don Kurtz's original model for the Roe P stars. And so I talked to him, and what I did then is, if you take evenly spaced triplets and pre-whiten by it, you get rid of all the power. That's one test. If you look at the phases of the modes within the triplet, they have to have a certain relationship so that they're all lined up when it points at you. That works. This should be 0.5, and it is. And then, getting really bold, we said, okay, if there's some perturbation, we should be able to estimate the amplitudes of the different components. And we were able to do that too. The observations are dark, and the colors are the theory. And so that seems to fit pretty well. So I'm going to call it an oblique pulsator. The real mystery is, why does some of the modes in the star do it and others don't? That's the real that's the real puzzle. All right, getting back to convection, we've now looked at several stars as a function of temperature, and we're plotting their convective time scales on this plot. And so you can kind of start to see a trend here. And I've superimposed what mixing link theory would say. And you know, if you get rid of the error bars, you'd say, well, it's pretty different. I mean, it looks the same, but this is a log plot. The slope is actually quite different, which means the exponent of the dependence is different by quite a bit. Thanks. But the thing that kills us is these error bars. Look how big they are. I mean, that's really awful, isn't it? So we don't know the temperatures of our stars well. What a shame, because how hard is that? So anyway, Jim Bailey, who's over here somewhere, there he is, he's helping us, well, Sandia National Labs is helping us do an experiment of measuring the stark broadening of hydrogen line profiles in white dwarfs, because you'd think it's a solved problem, but it's not a solved problem at the densities in white dwarf photospheres. The broadening is actually, it's actually something we need to characterize, and that is part of the reason our temperatures aren't that great. All right, well, a few years ago, a new class of white dwarf were discovered, those that have pretty much pure carbon. Patrick Dufour is the one who first recognized that. We went and we looked for pulsations in these guys, and we actually found pulsations in one. Now, there are about five of these that are known, and I think the thing that's tremendously interesting about them, besides it being carbon and how do you make a carbon star, is the fact that these have, half of them have fields of megagauss in them. No other white dwarfs are even known to have kilogauss fields that pulsate. So there's no, these are the only megagauss white dwarf pulsators known. Okay, that's a clue there for something. And here they are on the HR diagram. I'm being slightly cartoonish. We don't know where exactly they are, but they're basically cooler than these guys, and they're hotter than these guys. And again, we can't nail down the temperatures, because if hydrogen is hard to calculate a spectrum for, imagine carbon, you know, with all the multi-electron, the difficulty of doing it. Okay, very last thing is, so here we are again with the log G plot. This is the instability strip. If you put a blue edge through it like this, and this is a cartoon of the red edge, then it seems to contain these stars. And so you might say, well, why don't we try to find some of these and see if they pulsate? And people have done that. Everything here that has a circle around it has been looked at and found not to pulsate. So it's rather discouraging. Now, the bigger the circle, though, the worse the error bars. So this is almost equivalent to no data. This is equivalent to no data. But for instance, these guys here, those are probably real detections, or non-detections, rather. Well, anyway, Lars had a student, Justin Steinfott, who was looking at this. We've been looking in Texas a bit. And Monday evening, we actually found something. So this is a low-mass white dwarf. This is the light curve. And this is a comparison star in the field. So when I first saw this, I said, are you sure you're not dividing by an eclipsing binary? Because, I mean, it's a 20% effect. All of those other points, you can say, well, they weren't that sensitive, those observations. They would have seen this. You know, so this is good. So we think we found a new extremely low mass white dwarf variable around 0.17 solar masses. This object should have a pure helium core. Lars was telling me that Boris Genzicki may have found one as well, more massive than this, but also probably low enough to have a helium core. So maybe we have two such objects now. All righty. And it's got a number of frequencies in it, but like I say, it's so new that I want a little time to think about it. I'd give the 90% chance of this being a real low-mass white dwarf pulsator. All right, so anyway, I just basically did the first part of this list. You can constrain core profiles, crystallization, convection, and you can do these other things too. Thanks.
Thanks, man. Thanks, Mike. Time for questions? Start with Tim.
Thanks, Connie. Thanks, Mike. That's beautiful. A comment and a question. The comment is about the very non-sinusoidal light curves, like the one you just showed. And
yeah.
Hans advised us, whenever it was yesterday morning, to take logarithms, otherwise known as magnitudes. And that may well make them less non-sinusoidal.
I know. You were saying that the last conference.
Okay.
I took it more seriously after I saw the Kepler data from earlier in the week. I'm not really willing to go there yet.
Okay. I'll buy you a margarita tonight and we'll see.
Yeah.
Okay. My question was about the diagram that showed the avoided crossings, the model that showed all those beautiful avoided crossings.
Yeah.
So my question is, what is causing that? It's not P and D modes, is it? It's something else.
No. It's
just help me understand.
Well, Masao could probably help me out here. It's the fact that I'm changing the size of the crystallized core.
Yeah.
And I think what's really happening is at that frequency, all of a sudden it goes from having 8 nodes to having 7 nodes. So imagine you go from 0 to 100% crystallized. You're removing the area of the star where it can have a node. And so eventually, as you expand the core, you're going to have to steal, you know, values of n or nodes from the mode, and that's the thing that's changing.
Okay. So, I mean, you can trace with your eye upward branches on that diagram.
Yeah, so all of these have the same physical character. Like this is a mode which is trapped in the core or larger amplitude there, and then that switches to here and then here and then here and then here. I'm zooming in as much as I can on those and they don't appear to cross. So
it's very pretty.
It is pretty. That's why I used color.
If we look at your picture on the left, you were saying, hey, that's smooth.
I know.
It is. It looks pretty smooth to me. And you were then arguing that you wanted your enough crystallization to get rid of one of your bumps in N squared. And then you were left with two. And the only remark I wanted to make is that you see a similar thing with two, or maybe three even, when you're looking at acoustic glitches in the sun from things like helium ionization. You've got two bumps from helium ionization, helium 1 and helium 2. And they've got different frequencies. I mean, frequencies with respect to mode number. But if you look at them over a limited range, it's like two sinusoids beating, which of course look just like a sinusoid.
Right.
Except if you go far enough, the amplitude goes up and down, and there's a zero with a phase shift. But if your observations are not over a wide enough range, you'll never see that, and it looks smooth.
Yeah, I agree with that. I guess the argument I'm making, and I think it's hard to make ironclad, is simply if I had this bump in there, I would see a lot more severe signal. So I think what I'm saying is I can rule out the presence of this but I can't say that there aren't a number of others. Okay.
Other questions? Sebastian?
Is there a possibility that the period that you see in your period spacing might be affected by the avoided crossings?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I'm not really all that put out by avoided crossings. Obviously, it depends on how many modes you have and where you define your period spacing. If you've got enough modes, I think it doesn't matter. But if you have an avoided crossing right in the region in which you're trying to measure your delta P, then yeah, I think it could be a problem. Yeah. If you have enough of them. Yes, if you have enough consecutive radial overtones, then it should average out.
So, Mike, needless to say, I'm very eager for you to go back with your log GT effective plot for the object that you have found, since we spent so much time not finding them.
We did too.
But with Justin and with Phil Aris, we did do theory on these, and I'm pulling up the plot because those lines, of course, are extreme extrapolations. You get a very low mass, stable hydrogen burning shells. Our red edge is at 9,000 Kelvin at a log G of 6.5.
So about here?
Yeah.
Yeah, where did that come from? I'm sorry.
Theory.
What was your criterion there for the red edge?
Brickhill, but for the Brickhill mechanism, but for these unusual, very big, puffy hydrogen envelopes, the algebra is slightly different, so it isn't a clean extrapolation.
Oh, because there's hydrogen burning and that changes the...
The radii are much bigger.
So. I see. Okay. So I did not take that into account.
Yeah, so that was a straight use of Brickhill for which the referee never really liked because of the sociological comments
bad.
You had made prior. But it,
because I
but it just, is published. It is a published result.
Okay, well, so. I think I saw the lines and I didn't really read where they came from, but you're absolutely right. If that's true, then perhaps everything veers to the left here and nicely includes the new star.
Well, thankfully,
yes, exactly.
Back to the question of the avoided crossings. There's actually another mode in that star that you didn't plot up there that was identified as L equal 2 because it didn't fit the L equal 1 asymptotic
right.
relation, and
That's
that
right.
may well be a mixed mode.
Oh, really?
I mean, it could be.
Okay.
Let's go. So this is going to be a really naive question. But in the SDB stars, when you have gravity modes excited, there's a whole bunch that are missing, right? There's some modes that are predicted to be there, and they're absent. And is it the case also here, or are they all there?
Oh, gosh. I wish they were all there. I mean, they're not all there. We generally get a smattering of modes. There's some stars like PG 1159 where you really have lots of consecutive radial overtones. Of L equal 1 and 2. In GD358, you have maybe 8 or 10 consecutive L equal 1 modes. In the rest of them, you don't have that. So it's just like the other stars you've been hearing, the non-solar like oscillators. You're always going to have modes missing. Basically because they get up to finite amplitude and then they fight over the energy, is as near as I can tell. And what determines who wins is some very fine balance of parameters we aren't able to measure.
Yeah, going back to this white dwarf you just found, this low-mass pulsating white dwarf.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence of it being in a binary?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry, I glossed over that. Yes, it is in a binary
it
system.
Is.
The period of the binary is 5.4 hours, and it's not commensurate with any of the frequencies we've found in our light curve here. So we don't think there's a binary explanation of it. But I said I was 90% convinced that it really is a low-mass pulsator. The other 10% is worrying about the binary nature of it. So it's not thought to be transferring mass either. So it should be a clean system with a 20,000 second period. But yeah, all of these low-mass guys so far have been found in binary systems.
Last question.
What about the crystalline core? Would we expect modes there? I mean, would have a very high speed.
Yeah, essentially, it would be those would be sort of torsional modes or shear modes. And their characteristic time scale is actually more like P modes. so seconds. And so when you really do the full calculation, which I did do in my thesis, you find that the amplitude of the G modes is extremely small in the core because there's an impedance mismatch there. And there's a factor of 10 to the 3 or 4 decrease in their amplitude. So the real way we do the calculation now is we just assume the amplitude is 0 in the core, and you kind of have a boundary condition with no vertical motion, sort of like an oceanic boundary condition.
Douglas. Okay, while Robert sets up his laptop, I'll give you the mic.
You were talking about partial crystallization. That's like slushy ice. And so if you're thinking of shear modes, I mean, that's awfully dissipative.
And you're right.
You need very few dislocations in order to get a nice oscillation.
I remember asking people who've done these sorts of calculations on crystallization how sharp the boundary is between frozen and liquid, and they can't answer that. Essentially, it's a free parameter. So you're right, if that is a dissipative regime, and if it's large enough compared to a mold.
In Texas, you may not know about this, but if you go to Portland
later, when the ice is... I've heard that. I've heard that.
Okay, let's thank Mike again.
Thanks.
Now we go back in the evolution, where Robert Szabo will tell us about the theory of our Lyrae stars.